operations which would not be possible if the oil and petroleum were not based on the dollar. Muammar Gaddafi was about to switch to the euro. Barack Obama is violating the War Powers Act, and if it was anybody but him, all of my friends of color and liberal hue would be all over Washington, D.C. this very minute to oppose that. And that brings us to what I hope is a future subject on this and other programs. Liberal hysteresis. A lot of people voted for him because he's black, not because he's right. And hysteresis means that having extended that, people are unwilling to go back to righteousness and justice. To judge a person, not by the color of his bleepy, bleepy skin, but by the character of his deeds. And this is a liberal, this is a progressive, this is a black analysis of the errors and wrongness of the policy and behavior of Barack Obama. So don't listen to no fool who says this is right wing. I come from the South, from the core, from the heart, from negritude. And what I'm seeing ain't right. And it's Barack Obama, who is the president of the United States. And we've got to overcome not only what he's doing, but liberal hysteresis. Liberal hysteresis. Look up that term, hysteresis. You'll know what I mean. I'm sorry to be so bold. Thank you for being so bright tonight. We'll be back next week with Earthwatch. And I'm sure we'll have equally interesting and enlightening conversations as you've had in the past few weeks. But think about that. How much can somebody get away with before a referee calls foul on the theft of identity of the culture of negritude, liberalism, progressivism, anti-war, and righteousness? Think about that. See you next week. I'm Robert Knight. This is Earthwatch.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf. A Saturday, you see, there we go, a Wednesday night, Thursday morning program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. That hasn't changed yet. With us this morning, Michael Swanwick. That should be, well enough. And good morning. Okay, yes, I said that, you know, to know that it's Michael Swanwick is enough. But what if you don't know? Well, there's always that possibility. So let me tell you, same thing I told you when I told you that Michael Swanwick was reading last Tuesday at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings. Michael Swanwick is one of the most acclaimed science fiction and fantasy writers of his generation. He has received Hugo Awards for short fiction an unprecedented 5 times in 6 years. We're talking about this off the air. I do believe you are the most nominated writer.
The losingest writer.
Okay. Well, my guest next week, Rick Bowes, thinks that he's lost a lot as well, but he hasn't been nominated as many times as you. So anyway, let's see. He's blah, 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 blah. His novel, Stations of the Tide, was honored with the Nebula Award and was also nominated for the Hugo and Arthur C. Clarke Awards. The Edge of the World received the Theodore Sturgeon Memorial Award and was nominated for both the Hugo and World Fantasy Awards. Radio Waves, a favorite. Anything with radio, anything about radio, it's always becomes a favorite. Receives the World Fantasy Award. His stories are frequently reprinted in the Best of the Year anthologies and have been translated and published throughout the world. He is the author of Griffin's Egg, In the Drift. I think that was the first book I read. That was a Terry Carr choice, was that it?
It was.
Yeah, Ace Books. Yeah, and I still have that autographed. Stations of the Tide, Vacuum Flowers, The Iron Dragon's Daughter, and its sequel, The Dragons of Babel. His latest, which is why the website is Flogging Babel. It dates back to.
That is, I've always been amazed that nobody's asked why there's no S&M porn. But
that's because they haven't met Babel, And also because it's an L, not an S, at the end of that blog. Anyway, Flogging Babel. Anyway, his latest novel, it's Dancing with Bears, continues the adventures of far future confidence tricksters, Dargar and Surplus, and is just out from Nightshade Books. Well, we've been reading about Dargar and Surplus for some years, haven't we?
We have.
Do me a favor, pull that thing a little closer to you.
Okay.
And
we have. I wrote several stories with them. In their first adventure, they accidentally burned down London. And as they were leaving London by boat, they look back on the burning city, and Surplus says, "I can't help but feel, in part, responsible for this. And Darger says, London has burned down before and it will burn down again. Lift up your sight to the horizons. And they set off to run a con on the Duke of Muscovy to make their fortune. In the next book, they popped up in Paris because the lads are infinitely distractible. And they proceed to bounce around Europe. Most of those adventures have not been written down, but they're all out there to be written down. I always figured that if they ever reached Moscow, that would deserve an adventure that would deserve an entire book of its own. And that book is Dancing with Bears.
Okay. Where it's good for people to start. It's okay, I should say, for people to start with Dancing with Bears if they've not read the other Darger and Surplus.
They do not need to know anything about the past. In fact, my editor, when I turned in the book, was saying, well, why don't you explain more about their past? And I went, I don't know anything more about their past. They met. They hit it off. They've been running scams ever since. And that's pretty much their past. They're not the kind of lads who look back. They look forward. In fact, that's like the key to Surplus. Surplus is a genetically modified dog. He walks on two legs. He has full human intellect, but he is, you only need to glance at him to realize he is a dog. And he is an American. He comes from the domain of Western Vermont, and he has all of the positive, forward-looking optimism of an American.
And the other?
Darger is a gray, faceless man, which is... great featureless man, which is useful in his profession. He's a bit of a melancholic, and he is quintessentially British.
Okay. What brought you to... what era do they live in? Tell us a little bit about their environment and the settings.
They live in the post-utopian era. Utopia is basically our time. And after the artificial intelligences that we let loose into the web rebel against humanity, there's a war which destroys a great deal, in the aftermath of which nobody dares to resurrect machinery or electronica for fear of letting these monsters loose into the world again. But their biological sciences are quite well developed, far in advance of anything that we have. So you have a world that is exotic, and yet foreign countries are very distant. And as a result, adventure has returned to the world.
Mm. How would you describe, within the large body of work, Dancing with Bears? It's... Well, almost everything you do is a departure from almost everything that you do.
I certainly try to make it different. This one is what Graham Greene called an entertainment.
Yeah.
Its main purpose is to entertain. It is an adventure novel. It knows it's an adventure novel. It has a happy ending. It has a happy ending. Even my wife will admit it's a happy ending.
She's nodding, Marianne Porter.
And she knows me too well. Its main purpose is just to make the reader happy. And if it hasn't done that, it's failed entirely. Now, because it takes me 2 or 3 years to write a novel, there are depths to it, the way there is with all my other fiction. But you can read this without the feeling that this is good for you.
Okay. Which Dragons of Babel? I don't know. I thought it was good for me. Those two books. I should keep a list in front of me. Otherwise, my mind.
Dragons
just,
of Babel and
the Iron
Dragon's Daughter.
Thank you. Are extraordinary titles. They're extraordinary books. And yet the entertainment doesn't stop in either case. It keeps going, and at no point do I feel, Oh, I have taken my medicine. It is good for me.
Well, I certainly try to be entertaining in all of my books.
Mm-hmm.
No getting around that one. Those two books, I should probably explain. Neither one is a sequel to the other, but they're both set in
the same universe.
It began,
First and last time you were on this program, in fact, at least live, because I've recorded you at conventions and stuff, was when Dragons of Babel came out. We talked at length about that universe and were there other possibilities for it.
It's basically an industrialized version of Faerie. They've got stretch limos and Armani suits. They have recordings of Count Basie music. And they're still elves and dwarves and Rusalkas and Tokolashes and all the other supernatural creatures of world mythology and behaving appropriately, but in something approximating our world.
Mm-hmm.
I thought those novels were a hoot, but...
They're wonderful. And the full-fledged politics, are what... struck me, and I'm not necessarily big on political intrigue, but it's in there so much so, or corporate intrigue really, but it comes down to the same thing.
It's definitely a lefty pair of fantasy novels. Most fantasy tends to be politically conservative because most fantasy is very nostalgic. It's looking back to the Middle Ages and saying, things were pretty good back then when we had kings and knights and such. No, of course not. This is America. We fought a war to free ourselves from foreign tyrants. We don't need to have a king back again. And whenever you're writing a fantasy and you're trying to just bring it into line with the political values of the person on the street, right wing, left wing, doesn't matter. We rather like having a democracy. It's actually kind of hard to fit a democracy into a fantasy novel because the received wisdom is so medieval, so Tolkien-esque.
Mm-hmm.
I'm afraid I am politically aware. I try not to bring these things to the fore, but I think you can't exclude them or else you're having a watered-down version of life.
Yeah. I mean, for me, it wasn't even on that kind of a level that it was on one side or another side of the spectrum. It was the sheer fact that it was there in a level that spoke to me more so than how does the king relate to his advisors or something like that. It was a political awareness that related to a fairy that I could imagine being related to our world today. Am I making any sense out of this?
No, it's definitely, I was... when
it's
I
been
was
a
writing,
long day for me.
When I was writing that
oh,
novel,
and by the way, everybody, happy Bloom's Day. But sorry, go on.
River run past Stephen Adams' place.
Yes.
Let's talk about Dancing with Bears.
Let's get back to Dancing with Bears and Darger and Surplus. Yes. Published by Nightshade Books.
Fabulously entertaining.
Yes.
When I decided to write the novel, I made arrangements to go to Moscow, because I had only spent 4 hours in Moscow in my entire life, and I figured that was not enough time for a novel that's set mostly in that city, almost except for the first three chapters, entirely in that city. So I went back for 2 weeks. I thought that was enough to learn the heart and soul of Moscow.
Mm-hmm.
And
said skeptically, yes.
Yeah. It was great. I was staying in a little flat on the Garden Ring of Moscow. A mile from Red Square, just a just a few blocks away from Patriarch's Ponds, which is where the Master and Margarita begins.
Oh, my.
So we went wandering, Marianne and I went wandering about. We started there for the Master Margarita. We found the park bench where it begins, where the devil walks up and deals himself into a conversation between a poet and an editor. And over the next few days, not doing this deliberately at all, we went to almost all the sites in the book. And when we left the ponds, left the Patriarch's Pond, which is a little park, it looks very British actually, we decided to go back to our flat the long way around so that we wouldn't be duplicating any streets. And as we went, we had a little tour book, and we're looking to see where we were. And we came upon the Tunisian embassy, and we saw, and we looked up in the tour book and found out that that was originally Beria's mansion.
Oh, my.
Beria's mansion is about three blocks away from where Bulgakov lived, which is to say all the time he was writing about the devil walking around in Moscow, that Beria was right there going past his window.
So it was nonfiction.
It was, in a way, nonfiction. And one thing about setting a novel in Moscow is that... is that you no longer have that assurance that everything is going to end out well. You know, the bad guys are not necessarily going to be defeated at the end. Moscow is a very scary place. I quite fell in love with it, but it is a dangerous place, and there's some dangerous people wandering around in it.
Mm. Does this explain the Russian soul? The fact that every Russian movie I watch is always so depressing, and
their history gives them good reason to be depressed. I found
where their heroes are named, you know, somebody the terrible, and
that's in Russian. That's actually Grozny,
which means
terrible, but it also means awesome.
Yeah,
great. You know. It's like Ivan the Really Cool is how it's meant.
Yeah, actually in the OED, terrible translates that way as well in English. It's just an arcane usage.
It's drifted since then.
Yeah. Although Fred Pohl uses it that way, still does. But go on.
And where did I start out from before?
Well, basically, going to Moscow for the research of the book and walking around.
I stayed there long enough that I was able to feel comfortable setting out to get lost in the city deliberately, and that is hardly enough. Oh, you're asking about the Russian soul. I found the times that I've been in Russia, I've been, you know, elsewhere in Russia as well. After a little while, you find yourself just compulsively coming up with theories about Russians and how they are and what they're like, trying to understand them. I've been in a lot of different countries, and you don't do this in any of the other ones I've been in, but in Russia, you really begin obsessing about what they're like.
Mm.
I was talking to a Russian... now an American citizen, last weekend, and she was questioning me about a story that I'd written set in Russia. And I said, tell me, do the Russians understand the Russians? He said, oh, no, no idea. So they are a mystery to the Russians, and if the Russians cannot explain them, I don't know who can.
Filmmakers, basically.
I found a couple of moments in Moscow were really useful for setting the tone of the novel. It's a comic novel. Dargar and Surplus are basically oblivious. I forget, the key to them is they believe that they are good people who are having a pleasant time.
Mm-hmm.
And they're completely deluded in this. So in the novel, they're up against some very dangerous people, one of whom... Chortenko is an analog of Beria, but there are people more dangerous than him in Moscow.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of different forces at play, and some of them are very dark. And the two of them have no idea whatsoever that they're outmatched. They think that things are going great, and inevitably they must triumph. And carrying this attitude around in Russia is essentially comic. But the two moments, I think, that helped define Moscow for me, the first was when I first went to Red Square, which is, of course, it's more rectangular. It's just a square in the sense of a city square.
Mm-hmm.
And you go, you enter through the Resurrection Gate, and you come out into the square, and to your right, there's the Kremlin walls rising up. And to the left, there's Goom Department Store. And up front, up ahead of you, is St. Basil's Church, that with the beautiful, bright
onion
domes.
Style domes.
Onion domes,
yeah.
Yes. And the square rises up before you, in a gently before you, and everywhere you look, there's not a scrap of green. Everything is man-made. And you stand there in Red Square, and you feel like you are in the center of the universe. In fact, if you look around, you see there are tourists standing at random places in Red Square getting their picture taken by their friends. And they're not getting it taken in front of Lenin's tomb. They're not getting their picture taken in front of St. Basil's. They're just getting the picture taken random places in the square because they want documentation. They were there at the center of the universe. And I said, ah, this explains so much about the Russians. Later on, I was in the Kremlin, and they let you see about half of the Kremlin. The other half, where they do the work of the government, is the bailiwick of very important people who, whenever they leave or enter, require a police escort to clear the streets ahead of them of all cars.
That must be a busy thing, you know, people going in and out. Yeah,
yeah, it's quite remarkable. And I sat in the secret garden. It's a little park inside the Kremlin. The Kremlin rises up above the city, and you sit there in the park, and you look out over the walls, and you look down on the city, and you just feel sorry for the little people down there. You feel morally superior to them. You feel great-souled. And I said, oh, God, pity the people who are ruled from a place such as this. And that, I think, at that moment, I think I understood a lot more about Russian history than I did before.
Wow. That gave you the context.
That did. Those were the two touchstones for the novel. And
the novel, again, being?
Novel is Dancing with Bears, Nightshade.
Nightshade Books.
Nightshade Books. And
I should mention again, by the way, that my guest is Michael Swanwick, Swanwick. I was properly chastised by a fellow WBAI worker earlier this evening who said, last week when you had that gentleman, who was, by the way, Lawrence Watt Evans, on the air, you didn't mention his name often enough. And especially, I'm used to the 5 a.m. hour. At this hour, there are people tuning in all the time, so we have to remind people of it. They're A, listening to WBAI in New York, B, that this is Hour of the Wolf, and I'm Jim Freund, and C, with me is Michael Swanwick, and parenthetically, the latest novel by him is Dancing with Bears. You were saying?
I was talking about Moscow. I can talk about the characters. I can talk about con men.
Actually, that's where I was going to take it next. I was going, because I love good con stories. I love TV shows like Hustle. I haven't really caught up to the American version, Leverage. Not directly a version, but that's a similar concept. Very often of con men who think that they are, you know, they're doing it for a good cause. So often you get these con artists in fiction that are, well, we, you know, Jim Rockford has to con these people in order to get it back for the girl in the hospital who you know, what has to get the surgery or something like that.
In actual fact, con men are never like that. Con men do it entirely for themselves. They're people, they have a little moral blind spot. But they're also the really good con men, the classic con men, were wonderful natural psychologists, students of human nature. Somebody like Joseph Weil, the yellow kid, he made $8 million over the course of his career, it's estimated. And that was back when $8 million was real.
Was actually $8 million.
Yeah. Was actual real money. He did basically all the cons there were. He wrote a really delightful autobiography, and he lived to be 100.
Wow.
Which shows that a clean conscience will keep you young. Now, the actual term, confidence artists used to be called grifters.
Right.
And there's always been other names for it. Confidence artists actually comes from a man whose name has been forgotten. But in the 19th century, he made a name for himself here in New York City. His con was he would go up to a complete stranger on the street and greet him as if he were an old friend, and engage him in conversation, and over the course of the conversation, convince this complete stranger that this was a good friend that he had somehow was not able to place. And then at the end of the conversation, he would say, "Do I have your confidence to lend me your watch until tomorrow?"
Uh-huh.
And at this point, having first convinced the mark that he was a friend, second, that he was trustworthy. Third, that his asking for the watch was a joke. And fourth, that giving it to him would be a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
This poor innocent would hand over a stem winder worth a couple of $100 to a complete stranger who would then walk off with it. And we look at this now and say, how did he do that? He had the gift of gab. Here's a really simple one. There was a deaf-mute dwarf. And
we're talking outside of the realm of fantasy here. This is human dwarf.
Okay. This is, again, I believe this was in New York City. And, again, this would be the late 19th century, early 20th century. In 1 year, United States Mint goofed, and they put out a nickel that did not have the words 5 cents on it. It just had a big V on it. So he would take a nickel and get it gilded and go into a cigar store, and he would point at a 5 cent cigar, and when it was taken out and put on the counter in front of him, he would take out the gilded nickel, put it on the counter, and slide it forward. If the guy didn't offer him change, he just pocketed the cigar and walked away with it. But 4 times out of 5, he would get $4.95 change and a cigar for a nickel. That was a good con, because how can you prove that how can you prove larcenous intent? And how many of us would have returned the $4.95?
Right. That's would depend on the circumstance, I would have to say to that. But how far back do con games go?
They go back as far as the invention of food.
Okay.
There was somebody who had two batches of grapes, and somebody else who didn't have any. That person didn't have any. Was thinking about how to get some of those grapes.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, all the Native American cultures and all the African cultures, probably all cultures anywhere in the world, have got trickster figures. Those trickster figures are always proto-con men. It goes back as far as you can imagine. And it's still here with us today. You know, somebody like Bernie Madoff, he's a con man, but that's not a very slick con. That's a very crude con.
Yeah, the whole Ponzi scheme.
Yeah, it was basically
a
Ponzi scheme. And it wasn't the original Ponzi scheme was quite an elaborate one. His was just very crude. He said,
yeah, it was very basic.
I can make more money than this. I've had people try to take me with far better. I was in Philadelphia. I was walking on the streets, and somebody tried to hit me up with a pigeon drop. And basically, the pigeon drop is one of the old standbys. It never grows old. Somebody finds an envelope of money right in front of you, and somehow you get involved with two other people, and somehow it's decided that everybody has a share of the money, but also everybody has got to invest some money in order for it to prove their honesty. This is a scam that can only work if you are essentially dishonest, and it does require a great deal of very glib talk. These people did a change on it. There was a little man with a strong generic African accent of some kind asked me to help finding an address. Went to the address, it didn't exist, and he, during the course of our conversation, kept saying that he'd be willing to pay me for showing him where the address was. And he took this wad of money out of his pocket, mm-hmm. you know, and it's like the sort of wad of money where you instinctively look around to see if there's a horse you can choke with it. It was indeed eye-popping, and of course I had no intention of taking any money from him for showing him an address that was a block and a half away. But he's telling the story about how he gave a lot of his money to somebody he met on the train. Obviously, that money wasn't going to be seen anymore. At this point, somebody else comes in and gets involved with the conversation. The man looks like a respectable businessman and tries to convince this newcomer that it's not safe to be waving all this money around, giving it to people. He has to put it in banks. He explains he's afraid of banks, and the newcomer says, well, we have things called automated teller machines. You don't ever have to go inside the banks. And I had figured out that this was a con game at some point mm-hmm. after the second person came in. And I kept the conversation going for as long as I could to see what I could learn. But it was about this point that I realized I could not figure out where it was going, and I dealt myself out. I said, you guys are con men. I walked away from it. Later on, I realized what would have happened would have been they would have had me show how I can take money out from the ATM machine
uh-huh.
and then how I could put money back into the ATM machine. And at one point, the envelope with my supposed money in would have changed hands and I would have been depositing squares of rectangles of newsprint. That was very elegant. It meant that I would not learn that I had been cheated for at least a day.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, it did not require for me to be greedy to be taken. I could be taken just thinking that I was doing a good favor to somebody.
Yeah, on the TV show Hustle, they always maintain that it's only the greedy who can be conned, but I don't believe that's
true. And you know who said that first? Joseph Weil, the yellow kid.
Okay.
He's the one who said you can't cheat an honest man. It's a code to live by, but it's not necessarily true.
Yeah, yeah, I believe that. They did a variant on him in one episode. I'm pretty sure it was supposed to be him, and where he's played by Richard Chamberlain, who fakes his death at least two times in that episode as well. And very, very clever done. The early seasons of Hustle were very good. They're in their seventh season now, but it's sort of... I think the popular phrase is jump the shark about season four. Have you ever seen that?
I've never seen it.
Oh, you would probably enjoy it because the first three seasons, each season series being a British show, consists of only six episodes, but each one would be dedicated to a classic con. And some of them are a lot of fun. One episode being that... our two lead characters are dropped in the middle of Trafalgar Square without a stitch of clothing. And from there, whichever one returns to the home base at the end of the day with more money, none of it properly acquired, is the winner. And the And it's a wonderful bit with really good actors, where the two of them, and the person who's judging all this, the old hand member of the team, is played by Robert Vaughn, by the way, who's still in the series, still very much actively a participant in this show. And the final twist, spoilers coming, listeners, is that after they do all this and one edges out the other and all that, and the at stake is who will be the winner of the group, is that Robert Vaughn had simply bet another one that he'd get the two of them into Trafalgar Square stark naked. That was it. Actually, the con was over when it started. The main bet. But in the meantime, we see all the little tricks they can do. How to get their clothing, how to do this, how to do that. It's a wonderfully done episode. And in one episode, they're usually conning the deserved. Those who deserve to be conned. In one episode, they're trying to get some fellow to invest in a fake Bollywood movie. And they realize that the person who they are cheating is actually virtuous and is himself, that they have been led astray by somebody else who's actually should be the victim. So they actually go and attempt to make the movie. But what happens in the scope of the show, which often talks to the fourth wall, is that they change the aspect ratio of the show from 4:3 to 16:9, and they turn the episode into a Bollywood movie. It's very, and you haven't lived, by the way, until you've seen a 80-year-old Robert Vaughn in a Bollywood musical, by the way. It's really an eye-opener. And Adrian Lester, the star of the show, is brilliant, wonderful, wonderful actor. They really admire and talk about the classic cons. I suspect you'd appreciate it. What kind of studying did you do to get the cons? Did you develop any of your own?
Well, you only need one book if you want to write about con men. There's a book called The Big Con. I forget the author's name, but it may be easy to establish. The man was actually a linguist. He got interested in the slang of con men, and he got to know an enormous number of them during the great age of confidence swindles. And the result is he has a book that lays out pretty much every confidence game ever played. All the best stories are in there. All the other books that you read are just fill in details.
Would that be David Maurer? Is that the book?
Does it have the introduction by Luke Sante?
It does.
That's it.
Okay.
And he was the man was a true gent. When he was dying, he destroyed all the correspondence from the con men, so that after his death, the police could not use it to help track them down and locate them. He kept their confidence. He kept their trust afterwards. So quite an attractive man up and down.
Yeah, just like a magician who won't reveal the secrets.
Yes.
Same kind of camaraderie.
I've done my own variants of con games in my stories. It's easy to run a change, and there's the big con is like the wire, the rag, the big con that you see in The Sting, The Store. Those are the three big cons, and they're all like that in The Sting, where you have dozens of people creating a fantasy. You the roper finds a mark with money. The two confidence swindlers create a fantasy world around this person for
weeks. So it's an insider, somebody who's supposed to be on the
insider. Yeah. And they control this person's reality for weeks. They move him around. They get him to invest the money. They have that big elaborate scam. I did a story once called Snow Job. And actually, it was one of my favorite collaborations ever, because I had started when I was young a novel about time traveling swindlers. And I got about a chapter in and decided I didn't actually like these characters at all. So I dropped them. And Gardner Dozois, my friend who's one of the best story doctors in the world, I showed him the beginning of the novel. And he kept saying, well, are you going to write the rest of it? And I said, no, I have no interest in it. One day I went to visit him. He was at his typewriter. And I said, what's new, Gardner? He said, wait a second. Let me finish this page. He finished the page, and he took it out, and he tamped together this little stack of stories of pages. And he said, congratulations, Michael. You've just written a collaboration. And I said, well, I'm pretty sure I haven't. But what he had done, he handed me the story. What he'd done is he'd taken off the first page and the last page of the chapter, and written a new opening and written a new close, and he made it into coke dealing time travelers. And for that, I had created a new big con, which I called The Rock, which used a big crystal of cocaine as the MacGuffin, as the thing that you're chasing after around. And I think that would actually work very well, because, you know, a big drug deal, of course, involves a great deal of money, and also this very strong possibility of police officers coming at the end. So that was a change I made. I made a few others in stories. I try to make to throw in one element when I change a con game, so that it's not actually practical with our current technology, because confidence swindlers do read fiction about their own profession. It's like the Sopranos watching all the old gangster movies. They have a strong interest in the history, and if you come up with a new con, they'll pick it up and they'll run it on the streets. So I try to be responsible.
That's a good idea. When The Sopranos was the thing, occasionally I would find myself in certain neighborhoods in Brooklyn, maybe at a good Italian seafood restaurant or something like that. And occasionally, by coincidence, it was the day after The Sopranos had been broadcast on HBO. And I would hear these guys going on about, well, did you see what he did in that episode where blah, 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 did blah, blah, blah to something? You know, Tony could do that to Vinny. That could happen. That could happen. The other one saying, yeah, he really wanted to die. Yeah. They took that stuff seriously. They really did. It was a fascinating kind of thing. So why a dog?
It was a gift from heaven. I was just word doodling one day, and I had read Thomas Pynchon's Mason and Dixon. And there's a great scene in there with a talking dog. And I said, I want to do a talking dog, but I didn't want to do an imitation of his talking dog. So I was just started word doodling, and I wrote the description of a dog standing up on two legs with a cane and with lace ruffles at his wrists and neck, standing on the docks of London with sailing ships behind him, looking very much like an illustration from a Mother Goose rhyme. And then, because I needed somebody for him to talk to, I had Darger come up and begin a conversation. And at that point, the two of them basically grabbed the story away from me and just ran off.
Bonded and ran away.
And they just and I was playing catch up for the rest of the story.
Wow.
I have never before done any series characters, and that's because at the end of one of my novels, or any of my stories, the characters are not in any condition to be up for another story. I was talking to Carol Emschwiller once, and she said, I said, how are you doing, Carol? And she said, well, I just finished a novel, and I'm in mourning. These people I lived with for over a year are all gone. I feel as if they died. I said, don't you feel that way? And I thought, I said, no, I feel like when I finish that last page, and I just set it down in the manuscript, I pictured them like running down the street, waving their arms, going, we're free, we're free. I'm going to go off and I'm going to move to Detroit.
No more Swanwick.
I'm going to have a cheeseburger and no plot is going to happen to me. But
they're free of their authors.
But Darger and Surplus, as I said, they think they're having a great time. At the end of one story, they're perfectly ready to go up for the next story. They believe their lives are pleasant and uneventful. So they're always up for a new adventure. They're always up for a new con. They're always up for a new city, something new to learn, some new delight just around the corner for them. No matter what is happening, they're convinced the world is going to be a great place, and it always is a great place for them. That's what makes them such delightful company.
Which makes it sound like we have not heard the last.
I hope not. If this book is well received, which means that if people will actually go out and buy
it in large
numbers.
Yeah, because the critics have been happy so far.
The reviews have been glowing. Now all I need is lots of buyers. And if lots of people will buy it in such a way that my publisher wants to pay me lots and lots of money for the next one,
mm-hmm.
I want to continue their adventures further. I realized at one point that they've always been traveling eastward. They started out from England, from London, they went to Paris, they went to Greece, they went to a few other places in Europe, and they're wandering about. Then they go to Moscow. They're wandering about, but they're always heading east. They're on an accidental journey around the world. So my plan is to go to China next year to do some research. And then I have a plot in mind where basically the two of them conquer China. So that is an adventure that would be a lot of fun. And I really hope that I get to write it.
Okay.
And sooner or later, they've got to go back to the domain of Western Vermont,
mm-hmm.
and they've got to confront certain secrets in the Surplus's past.
Ah, so backstory will surface.
Backstory will surface. They'll have to discover what that is. And eventually, they'll come back to England, at which point, having circumnavigated the globe, they'll have to pause to take a look and see what they've made of the world. Because they think they're just wandering around having adventures, but really they're having an influence on the world that they're not aware of. And what they're doing really is they're putting an end to their era.
Very interesting. Well, I think we're going to take a break. I think it's going to be a very, very brief break, but I just found what I thought was an appropriate song. So, there's very, very few places that one can go with a Michael Swanwick inspiration in terms of music if you stick to the normal people. So here's a short piece from Frank Zappa.
Evelyn, a modified dog, viewed the quivering fringe of a special doily draped across the piano with some surprise. In the darkened room where the chairs dismayed and the horrible curtains muffled the rain, she could hardly believe her eyes. A curious breeze, a garlic breath, which sounded like a snore, somewhere near the Steinway or even from within. had caused the doily fringe to waft and tremble in the gloom. Evelyn the dog, having undergone further modification, pondered the significance of short person behavior in pedal depressed, panchromatic resonance, and other highly ambient domains. Arf, she said.
And speaking of ARF, you're tuned to listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio in New York City, WBAI at 99.5 FM and at WBAI.org. My name is Jim Freund. This program is Hour of the Wolf. And with me this morning is writer Michael Swanwick, who is, well, most accomplished and most entertaining and provocative and strange and wonderful and
8 feet tall
and 8 feet tall and bizarre and you know, surely I thought I chose one of the most obscure little songs I could. They knew it, you know, Marianne singing along with this bizarre little ditty by Zappa from an old album, well, mid-range album from his career. It's actually sort of post-Mothers. But I hosted Janet Coleman's show Cat Radio Cafe a few weeks ago while they were actually in Europe performing. And I played an episode of their show Poisoned Arts from the late 60s. And I played the episode Train of Thought.
Oh, wonderful episode.
Featuring Freddie the Cricket. And I mentioned on the air that you had heard that many, many years ago and found it inspirational.
Yes, I incidentally, I used to be able to recite the entirety of Billy the Mountain from Frank Zappa's albums.
Yes. I think if there was a time I could do that as well. That was, yeah.
If you get me in the right mood, I can still do it.
Okay. But instead, how about some of your own words?
I'm going to read a brief section, just a couple of pages from Dancing with Bears. This is an early scene, and the lads only make the briefest of appearances in it. Arkady Ivanovich Golagsky was drunk on poetry. He lay on his back on the roof of his father's house singing Last Cloud of a Storm That Is Scattered and Over, Alone in the Skies of Bright Azure You Hover. Which was not technically true. The sky was low and dark, with a thin line of vivid sunset squeezed between earth and clouds to the west. In addition, the winds were autumn cold, and he hadn't bothered to don a jacket before climbing out through an attic dormer window. But Arkady didn't care. He had a bottle of Pushkin in one hand and a liquid anthology of world poetry in the other. They came from his father's wine cellar. It was an indication of his characteristic good fortune that the one happened to be the purest Pushkin, just as it was an indication of his extreme callowness that he had chosen to drink it in tandem with a poorly organized selection of foreign verses and short prose extracts in mediocre translations. The bells began ringing from every church in the town. Arkady smiled. How it swells, he murmured, how it dwells on the future, how it tells of the rapture that impels to the swinging and the ringing of the bells, 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 he belched. Bells, 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 bells. Doesn't this thing ever end? Rhyming and chiming of the bells. I wonder what all the fuss is about. Arkady struggled into a sitting position, losing his grip on one bottle in the process. The Pushkin went bouncing down the roof, spraying liquid poetry and shattered in the courtyard below. The young man frowned after it and brought out the other bottle to his lips and drank it dry. Think, he told himself sternly. What do they ring bells for? Weddings, funerals, church services, wars, none of which apply here, I should have known. Also to welcome home the prodigal son, the errant wanderer, the hero from his voyages. Oh, damn. He staggered to his feet. My father. The dirt square before the city gates was thronged when Ivan Arkadyevich Golagsky rode through the great thorn hedge wall into town, with three brightly painted caravans in tow, a mounted stranger to either side, and the battered remains of a cyber wolf dragged on a rope behind him. His back was straight and his grin was wide, and he waved broadly to one and all. From the rear of the crowd, Arkady scowled with admiration. The old blowhard knew how to make an entrance. You had to give him that. "Friends," Galagsky cried, "neighbors, townspeople," and launched into a long-winded account of his exploits, to which Arkady paid little attention, for he was distracted by the sight of narrow window slides snapping open in the sides of the caravans. What was in there? Prisoners? Animals? Freaks of nature or the gene vat? Arkady slipped through the crowd, bent over double to avoid attracting attention, until he was crouching by one of the wagons just beneath a slide. He straightened to take a look. A huge hand clamped itself over his face, and he was thrown back onto the dirt. He found himself staring up at an enormous beast man. "Think you're pretty cute, don't you, chum?" the mountain of muscles snarled. By his accent, he'd acquired Russian from the tutorial ale. "Well, get this. You so much as touch the wagon, and I'll rip off your hand. Peek inside, and I'll squeeze both your eyes out of your head and feed them to you for breakfast. Understand?" Arkady nodded meekly and made no attempt to rise as the Neanderthal strode scornfully away. "Things are in the saddle," he muttered when he deemed himself safe again, "and ride mankind." Poetry made all things bearable. But then a dark-robed figure reached down and effortlessly hauled Arkady to his feet. He found himself staring up into the fierce and unblinking eyes of Koshe the Stranik, wanderer, pilgrim, who had come into town out of the wastelands a few weeks ago and who so far showed no signs of ever leaving. "God does not love a cowardly little sneak," Koshe said. "Sin boldly or not at all." Then he spun around, robes swirling, and thumped away, lashing angrily at the earth with the great staff he so obviously did not need for support. Arkady stared after him, then turned and found himself face to face with his father, newly descended from the wagon. A great surge of emotion washed through Arkady. He threw himself into his father's arms. "Ah me," he cried, "thou art not, no, thou canst not be my sire. Heaven such illusion only can impose, by the false joy to aggravate my woes. Who but a god can change the general doom, and give to withered age a youthful bloom? Late worn with years, in weeds obscene you trod, now clothed in majesty you move a god." "You're drunk," his father said. "And you were dead," Arkady explained. He punched his father in the chest. "You should have taken me with you. I could have protected you. I would have thrown myself in the wolf's slavering jaws and choked him with my own flesh." "Take this fool away from me," his father said, "before I do him a violence." In a kindly manner, one of his father's new friends took Arkady by the arm. "If I may," he said. One shrewd glance told Arkady that the fellow's face was covered with fur and that his ears, snout, and other features were distinctly and undeniably canine. "Oh, keep the dog far hence that's friend to men," he declaimed, "or with his nails he'll dig it up again." "Young sir, there's no need for this hostility." Arkady flung his arms wide. "You, hypocrite lecteur, mon semblable, mon frère." "Come now, that's much better," the dogman said. "Only you must call me Surplus." Arkady smiled broadly and extended his hand. "And you, in turn, must call me Ishmael."
Hear the sledges with the bell, silver bell. What a world of merriment their melody foretells. How they tinkle, tinkle, tinkle in the icy air of night. All the heavens seem to twinkle with a crystalline delight. Keeping time, time, time with a sort of runic rhyme. From the tintinnabulation that so musically wells. From the bells, 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 bells. From the jingling and the tinkling of the bells.
This is WBAI New York. If you would like to call up and speak with Michael Swanwick, our conversation on Hour of the Wolf will continue after this song. The telephone number here at WBAI is 212-209-2900. This, of course, is Phil Oakes.
From the swinging and the ringing of the molten golden bell. Of the bells, 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 of the rhyming and the chiming of the bells. Hear the loud alarum bells, brazen bells. What a tale of terror now their turbulency tells. Much too horrified to speak, well, they can only shriek. For all the ears to know how the danger ebbs and flows. Leaping higher, higher, higher with a desperate desire.
in a clamorous appealing to the mercy of the fire. With the bells, 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 with a clamor and the clang of the bell.
And you're tuned to listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifico Radio, New York City, WBAI at 99.5 FM and at WBAI.org. This is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund, and with me, very, very proud to have Michael Swanwick here. Only the second time live on the program in all these years.
Yes, I am hard to get.
Actually, that is true. I mean, easy enough at a convention to stop you for a little while and get you in front of a microphone. But to get you live on the air where we can do such things as take phone calls and all that and be extemporaneous, not as easy. But and therefore that much more of a thrill. If you would like to call up and speak with Michael Swanwick, as mentioned, phone number here at WBAI is 212-209-2900. If you are listening to the archive of this, it's the future. Sorry. Michael, put on headphones, please, in order to hear the calls. And, yes, good morning. You are on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I love this show. I love Michael Swanwick. I think I own just about everything he's ever written.
Just about? Well, never mind.
Well, God bless you for that.
And I think my favorite is The Iron Dragon's Daughter and the companion volume. And I was wondering, that's such a rich universe, if you were ever planning to visit that universe again.
I am. In fact, I have plans for two novels right now. I have about a half dozen stories to finish writing, and I can get to work on both of them, which doesn't mean that either will appear soon, because I'm very slow in the early stages. I'm mostly ideational. One is the next Dargon Surplus novel, and the other is a third and final Dragon novel. The problem with doing a third one is that the first novel with Jane was about a girl who had been stolen by the elves. So she had no place in that world. She kept trying to find a place for herself. There was no place for her. At the end, she had to come back home to Pittsburgh, which I, by the way, I think was a very happy ending. And the Dragons of Babel, the reason that I became interested in that at all was I came up with the character Will, and Will does belong in that world, and he can find a place for himself. So his chore was very different from Jane's. And I figured that that's sort of like thesis antithesis, and for a third novel to be justified required an idea that would make sense of all, that would be large enough to encompass the first two novels. Mm. And I finally came up with one. So I am working on the actual nitty-gritty details of exactly what happens in the plot at this point.
Well, that is very good news indeed. And I hope that all your Dargor and Surplus short stories will get collected.
I was going to ask that, yeah.
They will. The problem is, really, what I want, what the various presses all want, is a collection of nothing but them. And so far, there have only been three full-scale Dargon Surplus stories and four short shorts. I'm working on two separate Dargon Surplus stories right now. One of them is one of the six stories I want to get squared away soon. And so if I finish those two and take everything that's done, I've got about one quarter of a collection, because the stories, I've gotten very concise in recent years. I'm able to tell a story in half the length that I required 10 years ago. Unfortunately, what we all want is a whole book. That means I've got to write a whole lot more stories, and I've got to come up with a whole lot more good ideas. So I'm afraid that'll take a little while.
Perhaps you could include some of the transcripts of some of those podcasts you did with Greg Frost for Starship Sofa about how to run a con. And by that, we don't mean a science fiction convention.
Yes, those are a series. They can be found on Starship Sofa. I think they just finished about a week ago. I did about a dozen with my friend Gregory Frost, in which I sort of went against type. I played the optimistic Dargar, because Gregory Frost is really fabulous on voices, and he did a magnificent Dargar. He did the British accent. He got the class and character of Dargar down just perfect. And you have no idea how much fun it was doing these podcasts and very briefly being a totally cheerful, amoral person. It was enormous fun.
Well, I'm just thrilled with the news about more of the Iron Dragon Daughter world. That's great. Oh, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
And, of course, I'm eagerly looking forward to the next Dargar and Surplus novel, too, so to join with the one that just
Dancing
came out that I have.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thank you again.
Okay, bye.
Have a great morning. Bye-bye. Good morning. You're on the radio. Hello?
Yeah, okay. So, I've enjoyed some of your writing, Mr. Swanwick, and I'm... I am curious about what you're writing now, and I'm trying to get a couple of definitions here. The Iron Dragon's Daughter and the Dragons of Babel, those are dragon novels with the dwarves and elves?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now you had mentioned some kind of level of dwarves and elves, and I think some of the people who write in fantasy assume that some of us know the realm that you speak of. And could you just kind of clarify that a bit and elaborate a little bit? You said dwarves, elves, and some other name I did not recognize.
Oh, I have lots and lots of mythological creatures from around the world. I mentioned Rusalkas. Rusalkas are Russian ghost women and very dangerous to encounter. The Tokalasha is a South African spirit. There are Oni from Japan. And what I was doing with all of this is I wanted to write an American fantasy. When I was 17, either 16 or 17, I read Tolkien and he just rang me like a bell. And I wanted desperately to write a big fantasy. If I could have at that point, I would have written The Sword of Shannara. without a hesitation. And by the time that I was able to write a novel, I was made aware of the reasons why it was kind of cheapy for an American to be writing this stuff. I went to, in 1982, I went to Ireland, and for the first time I saw castles, and I saw stone rings, and ruined churches, and everything looked different than how I had pictured it. And I realized that people in the British Isles grew up with these things, sometimes literally in their backyards, and that Americans grew up with reading their books. So that I realized I could, the kind of stuff I'd wanted to write, I could only write imitation fiction. And then when I came up with the idea of an industrialized fairy, I realized here was a platform where I could write about things that I knew, you know, like high schools and shopping malls and strip clubs and such. It seemed very productive. And part of writing, making an American, was that all the mythological creatures, the mix of mythological creatures, came from all around the world. So that it was very much like the American melting pot or the American crazy quilt might be the better metaphor nowadays, since so few of us are really melting. That's a way of conveying some of the cultural richness you have in this country. We have people from all over the world who are getting along pretty well, actually, and everybody contributing something really interesting. That's That's why I did all of that.
I think it's a cool thing. Now, did you? Are you the first of your to do this? Is this a you started a precedent here? Because was that or?
I think for this kind of mix, I am the first. There have been little stories with Neil Gaiman, American Gods. That's something very similar.
Yeah, which, by the way, was just picked up by Tom Hanks's production company to be produced by HBO.
Yeah, my particular mix I think, unique. But there have been people mixing things together in science fiction and fantasy for a long time because that's just part of the game. You just take disparate things and put them together.
Well, what I think is unique in the two fairy books that Michael wrote are that Neil Gaiman's book is different gods coming to the U.S. and taking on American aspects. Michael's book is, as he said, an industrialized fairy. And that is a concept, the idea that you have iron dragons. They're not your ordinary ancient Celtic dragons or Chinese dragons or the dragons of Naomi Novik fighting in the Napoleonic Wars. They are the mechanism, the fact that it's taking urban fantasy away from just a city and putting it into skyscrapers.
Well, I like this. Would you mind dispelling the Russian ghost woman and the South African spirit for me, please?
Rusalka, Russalka, and the Tokolashi, Tokolashe, I believe.
Great. Well, look, I'm going to go to St. Mark's Books and look at some of your work tomorrow. Thank you.
Yeah,
thank you.
I highly recommend that.
Okay. Good night. Thank you
good
very
night.
Much.
Thank you so much. Have a good morning. All righty. And hi there. You're on the radio.
Good morning, James.
Good morning.
Tricksters and confidence men. Mr. Swanwick, have you read, since I do consider, obviously, the folklore trickster a confidence man of sorts in many cases, Paul Radin's masterful text on tricksters?
I don't think so.
R-A-D-I-N. He wrote the seminal volume on the culture of the trickster worldwide. He actually also did a volume on the great Native American trickster Nanabush, Winnebijou, Manabozho of the woodland central woodland tribes, and told his story, but with parallels. Now, I want to ask about famous American cons. Would you consider, well, first of all, what films other than The Sting would you recommend as good con films?
The Grifters.
Yes, okay.
And Only a Paper Moon.
Paper Moon, absolutely.
Okay. How about, say, specifically, well, okay, I'll get to that in a second. Would you consider among the great classic American cons two that I have in mind? One, the famous figure of Joshua Norton, who for many years passed himself off as the Emperor of Norton.
But he was the Emperor Norton. Nobody was entirely sure whether he honestly believed this. The suspicion is that he went very genially and gently mad and believed this. But everybody in San Francisco accepted him as
the
emperor.
Yes, they did. It's interesting. And, of course, you know, they still have an Emperor Norton Day every year.
Yes, and there is in science fiction an Emperor Norton Award.
For
San Francisco science fiction.
I did not know. The other con...
Best SF and SF?
The other film that I was thinking of that mentions a specific con is the famous one of the Baron of Arizona, the individual who in 1883, I believe, claimed actually, if not two-thirds... if not the entire state, two-thirds of the state of Arizona is his own.
And he really was Vincent Price.
He was. That was a great film.
I think the classic American con, of course, was selling the Brooklyn Bridge.
Well, that's it.
And the man who did that did it twice a week for years. He made a regular living out of selling it.
Wasn't there a science fiction short story about a fellow who kept on selling the Brooklyn Bridge until one day he sold it to an alien, never knew it, and the aliens came and it wasn't the Brooklyn Bridge, it was the moon. He sold the moon to various people, and one of them was an alien. He didn't know it, of course.
Sounds very Frederick Brown.
Is that a Frederick Brown story?
I'm not sure, but it sounds very Frederick
Brown. There was
also
a Norman Spinrad story in which in a future America where America's fallen to third world levels,
a Japanese
businessman buys the Brooklyn Bridge.
Ooh,
and
right.
Then has it transported back to his estate in Japan. And the man who is selling the Brooklyn Bridge is a bit of a con man. He's doing it for the good of his country, to bring in the money, which is desperately needed. But everything is for sale. And at the very end of the story, and such, I thought was quite nice, he receives a present from the businessman, and it's a gold brick. And
that's right.
And he laughs at this, and then he feels the weight, and he realizes it's a brick made out of solid gold, and he doesn't understand the message of it, but the reader and the businessman do.
By the way, I know Jim is a favorite character. Jim is a fan of this particular character. Wasn't there a Maverick film, James, in which the Central Core is a great con scheme?
Oh, absolutely. It's called Maverick. Yes.
Yes. And apparently,
it's a recent film. It's not that. It's you know the TV series was in the late 50s.
But
the movie is only about 10 years old.
10 years old. Yes.
Jodie Foster and Mel Gibson and James Garner, of course.
They run a great con. One last question, Mr. Swanwick. In your con travels throughout history, did you ever run into a delightful, lovable rascal known as Soapy Smith?
Yes.
The individual who apparently put, what was it, $20 bills, or at least one $20 bill into a bar of soap?
He would have a stack of soap, and wrapped around several of the bars were $1 bills, and a couple of bars were $5 bills, and one of the bars had a $100 bill, and he would be selling these bars of soap for 50 cents. So your odds, if you got one of the bills, you came out ahead. And he sold lots and lots of soap. And oddly enough, the only people who ever found the higher denomination bills were his shills.
Right. Yes.
Sounds like the lottery.
Listen, good luck. And I hope you do come out with the Dancing with Bears is delightful, by the way. Thank you. And I hope you do come out with a short collection of short stories.
Or a long collection of
short stories. And do include more mythological creatures from South Africa, because as far as I know, you're the only person I've ever heard mention Toko Ashe.
Well, thank you very much.
Have a good day.
Take care. Time for one more call. Hi there, you're on the radio. You might want to turn your radio down.
Oh, can I turn my radio down?
Yeah, well, it's easier for you because the delay gets confusing.
All right, okay. Have you heard of the Badger? Badger game?
Oh, yes.
Oh, what? Oh, that's a good one, is it? What about, everybody knows Three Card Monte.
Three Card Monte, who was, I'm trying to remember now. There was one of the great con men, and his only weakness was Three Card Monte. And he would run these cons, he would bring lots of money, he would earn lots of money, and then he would lose it all on Three Card Monte games. It got so that the three-card Monte players followed him from town to town because his business was so good. And, in fact, he inadvertently made a contribution to the American language. When a friend of his, a fellow con man, he had just spent like 8 hours playing three-card Monte, and his friend took him aside and said, "Can't you see that the game is rigged?" And he looked at his friend with this desperate look on his face, and he said, "But it's the only game in town."
What about this one?
He was the first one who said that.
What about the lottery ticket? You're a foreigner from a different country. You have a winning ticket. You get the number from the previous day, right?
That sounds familiar.
And you run across a telling suite. You say, "I'm a foreigner to this country. I have a winning ticket, but I can't catch it. Can you give me X amount of dollars for it?" And they go in and check out the number, they see the number, everything right for this previous day. And a lot of people got caught with that. The old lottery game. And then there's the one with the coins. The guy come up with some foreign coin. There's a doctor naming it, or a lawyer. Say, if you find these clones, you'll get $500 reward. You'll get a handsome reward. Bring it to this address or mm-hmm. whatever. You hear that one?
I can do better than that. I can, but will not name a WBAI staff member who went for it.
Oh, you kid. The clone one.
You know, I
the coin one on Times Square, no less. On Times Square, no less.
I think the reason why stories about confidence men are so popular is that all of us decent, law-abiding, respectable people have fantasies about living on the wrong side of the law. But you know, you think of like
here at WBAI, we think that's the correct side of the law.
But you know, if your fantasy you're having involves you shooting people with a gun, your imagination is probably good enough that you've got some sympathy for the person lying there bleeding, and you can imagine him hurting. And that kind of ruins a pleasant fantasy. But with a well-run con, you remove the money from the people without actually causing them physical harm. So that's a much more pleasant fantasy. It allows you to imagine living on the wrong side of the law, but at the same time retaining your essential human decency.
Okay, what about
Yeah, we're running low on time, by the way.
Okay, I just had it. Okay, I'll tell you next week. When you get my age, you know, you got to write it down.
Yeah.
Keep doing what you're doing.
Same here. Show. Thanks so much. Have a great morning.
You have a good one, always.
Okay, bye-bye.
And your guests, too, now.
Oh, absolutely.
All right, bye.
And my guests are, well, we haven't heard, well, retroactively, we've heard from Marianne Porter because I did a show with her about Hope Merlies, who was a dead guest of honor at ReaderCon a couple of years ago. But we will hear that at some point in the future. But with us this morning for another 3 minutes until we have to get off is Michael Swanwick. And we should go through a few of the how to find things Swanwickish. And first, let's spell the name Swanwick. And armed with that name, you can go to a website.
Yes.
Flogging Babel.
Yeah.
Which is
my blog.
Right.
And it's www.floggingbabel.blogspot.com. You can go to my basic site, which is michaelswanwick.com.
Yeah, that's probably the easiest because that then leads.
And there's a link to the blog from there. And I am, God help us all, on Facebook, where a couple of times a week I post a photograph of my breakfast.
There you go. Exactly. the latest book is Dancing with Bears. And it's, you know, if you like con games, if you like science fiction, if you like entertainment.
If you like fun.
If
it's
you like
a
fun
book is basically what it intends to be. There are depths to it because when you spend 2 years writing a novel, alas, I am a slow writer. It's very easy to put depths into a book. There's plenty of time to do that, but it's primarily meant to be an entertainment.
Yeah. Now, Babel is still in print, but Iron Dragon's Daughter?
No.
That has been elusive.
Yes, I have to have a long talk with my agent about this.
Yeah, yeah. It is a highly sought-after book. I have seen it posted in popular places for hundreds of dollars. It's, you know, which at the moment is about the only way one can find it outside of a used bookstore or, and I definitely advocate this, your local library. But
yes, an interlibrary loan is your friend.
Yes, absolutely. But you do need to ask publishers a publisher or Michael's agent get this book back into print. What other books are currently in print of the fictional or nonfiction?
Stations of the Tide.
Oh, a classic.
Yeah, Stations of the Tide. Stations of the Tide, it takes place on a distant planet where the technology has been artificially held down to 20th century levels. And every 100 years, the ice caps melt and tides come up and swallow up half the land. And in that half of the land that gets buried, everything is in the process of changing so that birds become fish, starfish climb down out of the trees and burrow into the mud, trees become kelp. This is all natural processes. The only things that can't change are the human thing, are human beings and those things they brought from distant Earth. And they have to go retreat up to the highlands for the period there. And into this world comes a renegade magician, and he is pursued by a bureaucrat. It is my most complicated novel and the one that people have asked fewest questions about ever.
Really? Yeah, but that could be perhaps because they're so taken with it. You never can tell.
They tell me they like it and they don't want to hear my opinions on it.
Ooh, well, maybe their own are too close. Well, I hope it's not another 3 years before you're back on this program live.
Just as soon as I have an herb book out.
Yeah, well, you see, that's what you keep saying, and that's how it's been working out, and we'll settle for that. But in the meantime, everybody, go to your library, go to your bookseller, go to michaelswanwick.com and enjoy. In the meantime, tune in again next week for Hour of the Wolf. My guest will be Rick Bowes, and the week after that, Paul Witkover. So stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clappers with the inestimable Lister. And thank you again, Michael and Marianne.
Well, thank you for having us.
And good morning.
Necessary road to real liberation. Could we really win?
tuned to 99 Sync at WBAI. This is WBAI 99.5 FM New York, right here in New York City. 212-209-2900. This is how we do it on a Thursday, Juneteenth. Where is Les Payne when I want him, when I need him to explain to me Juneteenth?
This is Burn Baby Burn on the 16th of June, Juneteenth, on a Thursday. Your Friday begins today, your Saturday begins today, your weekend begins today, right here at Burn Baby Burn. Yes, I am. Sync, brand new music on Burn Baby Burn, brand new music on Pacifica Radio. 99 Sync, so we do it, y'all. 7 minutes after the hour right here. You know what to do. Burn Baby Burn, y'all. Sinker right here on a Thursday, Juneteenth, like I said before. We're gonna do this until 5 o'clock when you know what happens. Al Jazeera English kicks in right here, brand new. Wake up call, Esther,
6 o'clock until Andy Goodman comes in here and kicks some butt. Yo, democracy now more than ever. So we do it, y'all. Robert Knight in the afternoon. 5 o'clock, shot go, y'all. Yo, are you ready for the hip-hop takeover? Yo, Jamaica me crazy, man. Hip-hop takeover right here at the land of African Bambaataa. About time African Bambaataa comes up to WBAI, y'all. Fixing to be, let the motherfuckers know it's plenty fish in the sea. Now we sweating me just cause I got the tightest whore. But I couldn't find out that thing with a microscope. Give me dome, dome, da, 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 dome, dome, dome. I ain't tripping on your money, money, long, long, long. But my own TV production company. So tell Hop out to hit me silly. Anyway, Riri, what rhymes with your name freely? Money got you vacationing in Chile? Do you wanna sit on the bunk while I really, really, really? No, for real, really? Lay down doing the beach, they be feeding me my catfishes. Cause there's raining men, fat bitches. Yo, taking the streets in Greece. Fighting these imperialist fools, these capitalist fools. In the streets of Greece, the demonstrators are kicking ass. Yo, the show is dedicated to demonstrators fighting back on the streets of Greece, yo. Hey. What says you at 212-209-2900? Burn, baby, burn, yo. Love this woman from Barbados. Yo. Yo. Love this woman from Barbados, yeah. Flying fish and cocoa. So we do it. 10 minutes after 3 Eastern Standard Time. New York, New York. So wicked we had to name it twice. Hey. Thank you very much, Rebecca Brown, up in a place called Warwick. Selection time, y'all. Selection time. 99 sinker on the case, y'all. Selection time, y'all. Selection time. Selection time. Burn, baby, burn time. 99 sinker, list alive until you know when, y'all. So we'll do it, y'all. Feel me. Feel me. Feel me, baby.
Watch out for the vampire who will sneak up in the dark. Watch out for the big.
Ted Bafalufas in Greece, inventor of the movie Rockers. Burn, baby, burn, protesters on the streets, fighting back. Aya, aya, yo. The show is dedicated to the militant youths of Greece. Red, red.
I'm not